for the fourth IAS Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment and Prevention. The Young Investigators Awards of $1,000 each go to an investigator under 35 years of age who receives the highest score in their track. There are four award winners this year because two candidates received equal scores for their abstracts in track C. In addition to the prize and certificate, the prize winners will also receive a complimentary one-year IAS membership. The track committees were actually quite impressed with the very high quality of the abstracts from the young investigators. And I should note that track A award received one of the highest abstract scores in that particular track. The four IAS 2007 Young Investigator Award winners are in track A for basic science, Miranda Smith from Australia, for her abstract vaccine-induced CD8 T-cell control reversion of SIV GAG immune escape mutants. In track B, for clinical research, treatment and care, Marcello Pinti from Italy for his abstract upregulation of the mitochondrial PRSS15 during lipodystrophy. In track C, biomedical prevention, Viviane Lima from Canada for her abstract, the impact of heart on HIV transmission, the interplay of HIV, RNA, plasma viral load, adherence and drug resistance over time. And also in track C for biomedical prevention, Dr. Borka Kodi from India for his abstract co-infection of HIV, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, and the associated risk behaviors among injection drug uses in two northeastern states of India. Please join me in congratulating these talented young investigators as they receive their awards.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this plenary session on promising research and the road to practice. The prospects for RNA interference, the next steps on male circumcision and novel treatments on the horizon. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Maurice Payne. I'm a federal senator for the state of New South Wales in Australia and the chair of the Parliament's parliamentary liaison group on HIV/AIDS. It's my role this morning to introduce our first speaker, Professor Robert Bailey. Professor Bailey received his PhD in biological anthropology from Harvard University and his MPH in epidemiology from the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. I understand that, in fact, he began his career as a paleontologist, studying the behavioural ecology of squirrel monkeys in the Colombian Amazon and baboons in Kenya. However, since 1995, he's devoted most of his research activities to the issue of male circumcision as a possible HIV prevention strategy. He's conducted circumcision-related studies in varying communities in countries like Uganda, Kenya, Malawi, Zambia, and the United States. He has studied adverse events and conducted needs assessments which are associated with medical and traditional circumcisions in Kenya. The professor is also the principal investigator of the randomised controlled trial of male circumcision to reduce HIV incidence in Kisumu in Kenya. And he has served as a consultant to the WHO, to UNAIDS, to UNICEF, the World Bank, to USAID, the CDC, and a range of other national and international governmental and non-governmental agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor Robert Bailey.
Thank you for that kind introduction. 4,000 men get infected with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa every day. Probably 3,000 of those men are uncircumcised. How many female partners of those 3,000 men will become infected by those men is beyond my abilities to estimate, but certainly it's now a largely preventable number. Male circumcision has been likened to a vaccine. Not a perfect vaccine, but an effective one, about 60% effective in preventing new HIV infections in adult heterosexual men. I'm going to very briefly review the evidence for the efficacy of male circumcision in reducing HIV acquisition and discuss some guidelines for the way forward, the road from evidence to practice. As we're all aware, our present weapons against heterosexual transmission of HIV are severely limited. Here in the white font are the tools that are currently widely accepted, although the evidence supporting their effectiveness is sometimes questioned. They include the A, B, and C's, the abstinence, be faithful, and use condoms for risk reduction, early diagnosis and treatment of STIs, and voluntary counseling and HIV testing. We're all very hopeful that additional weapons will be developed and will be proven effective. Unfortunately, we've had a few setbacks recently in microbicides and the diaphragm, and just yesterday we heard a disappointing report from Wanza on HSV2 suppressive therapy. But we've learned a lot that we can put to good use, and we must remain hopeful. Male circumcision is not a new health-related intervention. The ancient Egyptians, over 4,300 years ago, performed the procedure at least in part for health reasons. And it's developed independently in several disparate cultures around the world. Now approximately 30 to 35% of adult men worldwide are circumcised. In Africa, about two-thirds of men. It's practiced mainly for religious reasons, as seen here in the photograph where a traditional moyle is circumcising a Jewish child 8 days after birth, and for cultural reasons, as with these adolescent boys who were circumcised at ages 10 to 18 as a rite of passage to manhood in Bungoma, Kenya. Circumcision is a simple surgical procedure. It's very safe when done by a trained practitioner under antiseptic conditions. But like any surgical procedure, it entails risks, and any benefits of circumcision must be weighed against the potential harm. Aside from HIV infection, male circumcision has been found to be protective against many other conditions. In this slide, summarizing many of the studies compiled by Helen Weiss, I believe, you can see that neonatal circumcision has a strong protective effect against urinary tract infections in infants. The female partners of circumcised men are at less risk for chlamydia, and men who are circumcised have about 60% less likelihood of contracting chancroid. And invasive penile cancer is very rarely seen in older circumcised men, unlike in uncircumcised men, especially in underdeveloped countries where it's seen all too often clinically. A multi-site cross-sectional study found that most strains of HPV are less prevalent in circumcised men, and the partners of circumcised men experience less cervical cancer. The evidence for a protective effect against syphilis and HSV2 infection, which we'll visit later, is less clear. Lastly, circumcised men don't suffer phimosis or paraphimosis, which often lead to balanitis in uncircumcised men and the need for a medical circumcision. Turning now to male circumcision and HIV infection, prior to the conduct of 3 randomized controlled trials, there was ample evidence of an association between HIV infection and lack of circumcision. There are 4 ecological studies, at least 37 cross-sectional studies, and 15 prospective studies that have found a significant association between HIV acquisition and lack of circumcision. In the prospective studies that controlled for confounders such as differences in sexual behavior, religion, age, alcohol consumption, etc., the relative risk of HIV infection among circumcised men ranged from 0.52 to 0.14, or a 2- to 8-fold increased risk of HIV infection for uncircumcised men. This graph from a paper published in AIDS in 2000 by Weiss, Quigley, and Hayes. They found, of 27 observational studies published at that time, 15 controlled for at least some confounders. And they calculated an adjusted odds of HIV infection for circumcised men. As shown here, all 15 studies had an adjusted odds ratio of less than 1. And in 10 of the 15, the confidence intervals did not cross 1. So the overall adjusted odds of HIV infection for circumcised men was 0.42. Remember that number, 0.42. This means that an uncircumcised man According to these observational studies, we're 2.5 times more likely to be HIV infected than circumcised men. This amounts to a 58% protective effect of circumcision against HIV acquisition. For those of you who are not familiar with the uncircumcised penis, in this schematic, above is shown the flaccid uncircumcised penis, and below the erect uncircumcised penis. Notice that the foreskin covers all or most of the glans penis. The red area is the inner mucosal surface of the foreskin, which when the penis becomes erect, becomes exposed. Studies by McComb and Short have shown that there's a substantial layer of squamous epithelial cells on the surface of the glands and the outer surface of the foreskin. This is a section of foreskin tissue from a young man in Chicago. On your left is the outer surface of the foreskin showing the thick layer of keratin serving as an epithelial barrier for access to the underlying immunocompetent target cells. In contrast, look at the section on the right-hand side. This is from the inner mucosal surface of the foreskin. The layer of keratin is very thin, if present at all, allowing HIV and other pathogens access to the HIV target cells lying near the surface. This is further shown in these beautiful slides published by Scott McComb and Roger Short, where on the left, the Langerhans cells appearing in green are beneath the epithelial barrier, whereas on the right, they're close to the surface with extensions reaching right to the edge of the mucosa, easily accessible to HIV if it should just happen to be in the neighborhood. Back to the foreskin of the young man in Chicago. On the left is tissue from the outer surface of the foreskin. Upon introduction of HIV to the tissue in explant culture, no HIV was present in the cells of the outer surface after 12 hours. No HIV was taken up or seen to penetrate the epithelial barrier. In sharp contrast, in the tissue from the inner mucosal surface of the foreskin, a great many of the Langerhans cells shown in yellow and the CD4 positive T cells shown in green were found to take up HIV. When we compared cervical tissue and the inner surface of the foreskin, 6 times more of the cells in the foreskin tissue were infected than in cervical tissue. And the cervix is considered to be the primary site of sexually transmitted HIV infection in women. Most of the evidence I've shown was actually available, and much more, in 2000, 2001. At that time, over 35 observational studies, the ecological relationships with high HIV prevalence in non-circumcising communities, the compelling biological findings, as well as the clear biological plausibility, all this was available. But only a handful of scientists and no policymakers were persuaded that circumcision should be considered as a possible new HIV prevention strategy. It became clear that randomized control trials were going to have to be done before the international health community could be persuaded to move. This was because all the studies to that time were observational. Confounding was possible. Also, if circumcision were actively promoted as preventing HIV acquisition, men may get circumcised and feel protected. As one man put it, "Ah, I have a natural condom." And circumcision could actually increase rather than decrease HIV incidence. And of course, there were concerns about safety. Could circumcision be done in adult men without causing undue harm? So the results of the 3 randomized control trials are now available. All 3 were stopped before they went to full completion because the protective effect of circumcision was found to be so strong that there was minuscule statistical chance that it was not effective. And it would not have been ethical to continue to withhold circumcision or an effective prevention method from those in the control group. Here are shown, below the top horizontal line, the results of the 3 trials. You can see that the results are remarkably strong and remarkably similar. The South Africa trial, which was stopped nearly 2 years ago, had a result very similar to the summary odds ratio of the observational studies, and a relative risk of 0.40, or a 60% protective effect. The trials in Kisumu, Kenya, and Rakai, Uganda, were stopped by their DSMB on December 12th of last year, and the results were very consistent with the South Africa trial. Overall, the trial showed a relative risk of 0.43, a reduction in HIV incidence in circumcised men of 57%. One would be challenged to find any public health intervention with such a strong and consistent efficacy. Certainly, we have nothing like it in the field of HIV prevention. So 6 years, about $23 million, and probably 1 million new infections that might have been prevented later, we arrive at the same conclusion that was staring us in the face in 2000, 2001. I'm not sure what could have been done differently, but it does raise the question whether we've raised the bar too high for converting evidence to action in the face of this crippling pandemic. Perhaps for the next intervention, the threshold of proof will not be quite so high, and we can start acting sooner. For circumcision, the time for action is now. Based on the results that became available last December, the WHO and UN agencies convened a consultation of international experts in Montreux, Switzerland, on March 6 to review the evidence. 3 weeks later, on March 28th, they came out with this statement. The efficacy of male circumcision in reducing female-to-male HIV transmission has now been proven beyond reasonable doubt. This is an important landmark in the history of HIV prevention. Scaling up male circumcision in certain countries will result in immediate benefits to individuals. Male circumcision should be considered as part of a comprehensive HIV prevention package. This statement, which in total is fairly detailed and comprehensive, provides the imprimatur of the international normative agencies for national governments, their agencies, and donors to now formulate country and region-specific policies toward provision of male circumcision services. In short, to move from research results to policy and implementation. An important question is, does circumcision work directly to reduce HIV, or is some of the protective effect of circumcision attributable to a reduction in other STIs, which then cause a reduction in HIV? We have results from two of the three randomized control trials. Shown here are the relative risks for incident infections of HSV2, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, and trichomonas. All of the relative risks are near one, and the confidence intervals all cross one. Remarkably, circumcision had no efficacy against any of the STIs measured, including syphilis and genital herpes. The results of our HPV studies still remain to be to come out of our lab. In contrast, circumcised men were about half as likely to experience clinical signs of genital ulcer disease. So despite there being no difference in the two groups in HSV2 incidence, the clinical manifestations of herpes, herpetic ulcers, were nearly twice as frequent in the uncircumcised controls. One thing that this suggests is that HSV2 suppressive therapy, if it suppresses genital lesions due to herpes, may have the greatest efficacy in reducing HIV acquisition in uncircumcised men and their partners compared to circumcised men and their partners. Remarkably, as we would expect, circumcision did not reduce the incidence of genital discharge, but did reduce incidence of genital warts, and did so by nearly sevenfold. Will sexual disinhibition erode the efficacy of circumcision? There's actually quite a bit of information now available addressing this question, which is the one most frequently asked. Kawango Agote conducted a very nice case control study comparing the sexual behaviors of men after circumcision to the behaviors of uncircumcised controls. She found no differences. The data from the three trials suggest, at least in those settings, sexual disinhibition did not occur. In South Africa, the circumcised men did exhibit riskier behaviors, but only number of sexual encounters was significantly greater in the circumcision group. And when the differences were controlled for in analyses, there was no change in the protective effect of circumcision. In the interest of time, I'll not review the evidence from the other two trials. In the Kisumu trial, we did an intensive study of risk behaviors in a subsample of our trial cohort. Christine Mattson developed an elegant method for creating a risk index. Looking at the risk scores of the two groups, risk behavior declined significantly in both the circumcised and the uncircumcised men, with greater decline in the first 6 months in the control group, but equal risk scores in the two groups at 12 months. We used non-ulcerative STIs as biological markers for risk, and these were quite consistent with the behavioral results. The circumcised men started with greater prevalence of these STIs at baseline. They had greater incidence up to the six-month visit, but the incidence of STI in both groups were equal by the 12-month study visit. In summary, then, in the context of the RCTs, with repeated study visits and intensive behavioral counseling, we see no evidence of behavioral disinhibition. In fact, we see a reduction in risk behaviors and their biological markers during the participation in the studies. Well, what's the potential impact of circumcision interventions on HIV incidence and prevalence in varying populations? There have been several modeling approaches to this question, but in the absence of current interventions, we actually already have a very good idea of what the impact is likely to be. And that comes from the ecological evidence. There's a strong inverse correlation between the prevalence of circumcision in countries and the prevalence of HIV. All the highest HIV prevalence countries are those where circumcision is little practiced. In fact, no country with nearly universal circumcision coverage has ever had an adult HIV prevalence higher than 8%, including countries such as Cameroon, where in 1997 a survey found that sexual behavior was higher than that in countries with a prevalence of around 25%. A similar picture is seen in South and Southeast Asia, where overall HIV prevalence is much lower than in Africa, but the countries with the highest HIV prevalence have little male circumcision: Papua New Guinea, Cambodia, and Thailand. Conversely, HIV prevalence is extremely low in those countries where most men are circumcised, as in Pakistan, Bangladesh, Indonesia, and the non-Muslim country, the Philippines. There have been several different modeling approaches to predict what will happen once we're able to roll out circumcision. Williams et al., assuming 100% uptake of circumcision, estimate that circumcision could avert 2 million new infections and 300,000 deaths over 10 years and 5.7 million new infections over 20 years. 100% uptake, though, is probably unrealistic. McCessin et al. Reported at the meetings in Toronto that the 50% uptake in Soweto, South Africa, between 32 and 53,000 new infections could be averted over 20 years, and HIV prevalence would be reduced from 23% to 14%. Nico Nagelkirki, based on our data from Kisumu, estimated that prevalence in Nyanza province would decline from 18% in men to 8% over 10 years. And Ron Gray and collaborators in Rakai, where HIV prevalence is much lower, reckoned that the 50% uptake over 10 years incidence would decline to below 1%. And Rho, the reproductive rate of the epidemic, could decline to below 1 to 0.89%. In other words, circumcision could drive the epidemic to a declining state towards extinction. Well, what about cost effectiveness? How will circumcision interventions compare to other prevention modalities? Is it worth doing? Jim Kahn and colleagues at UCSF estimated that the cost per HIV infection averted over 20 years in an area of South Africa where the prevalence is 25.6% would be just $181. Of course, cost effectiveness is most sensitive to HIV prevalence in the population and the cost of the procedure. In a population where the prevalence is just 8%, cost per infection averted goes up to $550. In areas of Asia where prevalence of HIV tends to be between 1 and 2% or less, and many transmissions are not due to sexual contact, widespread circumcision programs are not likely to prevent a great many HIV infections. Widespread circumcision programs are unlikely to be cost-effective, but targeted programs to high-risk heterosexual men may be worthwhile. What's the impact of the pace of scale-up? This modeling by Gail Martin, John Stover, and colleagues looks at rolling out circumcision in a steady linear manner, the red line, versus scaling up gradually, the lower blue line, or scaling up early and rapidly, the upper blue line, all ending up after 8 years at the same level of uptake. Comparing the linear form of scale-up to the slower and faster forms, it's clear that if we delay, by the end of 8 years, we'll have averted 16.4% fewer HIV infections, and the cost per infection averted will be greater. On the other hand, the faster we scale up, the more infections we can prevent, about 16% more. And each infection averted costs us 10% less. Not delaying or putting our best efforts into providing services now will save lives and save money. The cost effectiveness of male circumcision, even using the most conservative estimates, compares very favorable to other HIV prevention interventions, some of which actually have limited evidence supporting their efficacy. Will circumcision be acceptable to people in communities where it's currently little practiced? If we provide the services, will they come? All indications are that they will come, and they'll come in large numbers, as they did to participate in the trials and as they are coming now to the few small projects providing the services. We have reviewed 13 studies of acceptability conducted in 9 different countries in sub-Saharan Africa. All these studies were conducted in non-circumcising communities before the results of the RCTs were available, in the absence of any concerted communication or education efforts. A median of 65% of uncircumcised men said they'd prefer to be circumcised if it could be done safely and at no or minimal cost. Women were slightly more enthusiastic than men about their partners getting the procedure. And the high proportions of both men and women, especially women, were in favor of their sons getting circumcised. Women especially point to increased cleanliness and reduced chances of a man carrying an STI as reasons why males should be circumcised. As sex partners, as sisters, as mothers, women are going to be instrumental in assuring rapid and broad uptake of circumcision in these communities. Any scale-up program should be sure to engage women and include them in plans for consultation and mobilization. As we provide safe voluntary circumcision services, they must be integrated with our existing HIV prevention measures. At a minimum, men seeking circumcision services should not be required, but strongly encouraged to receive HIV counseling and testing. Diagnosis and treatment of STIs should be available, and special behavioral counseling will be required to communicate the concept of partial protection and the dangers of resuming sex prior to full healing. Additionally, there'll be opportunity to include other reproductive health messages and services, including couples counseling, family planning, gender equality, and reduction of violence against women. It also offers a superb opportunity to gain access to sex partners of the men who, because they're sexually active in a high HIV prevalence community, are vulnerable and can gain from comprehensive reproductive services. In short, male circumcision services should be made available as soon as possible in regions where HIV prevalence is high and most infections occur through heterosexual transmission. Circumcision should be integrated with other HIV STI programs, prevention strategies, and should not be considered a standalone surgical procedure. We must install systems also for monitoring and evaluation, especially of adverse events and behavioral compensation. And we should consider innovative means to reach the maximum number of males. And some examples are providing mobile services, large medical missions, circumcision weekends, and others. There are many research questions that still need to be addressed. And just a few of these are, is there a protective effect against females, or for females? Is there a protective effect for men who have sex with men? And there are at least movements towards trials addressing these questions. How long after the procedure does it take for full healing and keratinization to occur? How much of the protective effect of circumcision is attributable to its effect against genital ulcer disease? What's the impact of circumcision on at the population level? So, in a sense, phase four studies need to be done. Will behavioral disinhibition, risk compensation occur? On the other hand, it could be just the opposite. Risk compensation could decline, or risk behaviors could decline, as they have in other, as we've introduced other interventions. And as we design and implement the interventions, there'll be many operational questions to be addressed. A recent WHO-UNAIDS convened consultation spent 2 days discussing operational issues, and I don't think we came close to exhausting the possibilities. So as we introduce and make circumcision services widely available, there will be many challenges to ensure that we do it safely, affordably, without discrimination or stigmatization, minimizing disinhibition, and communicating in community-specific ways the nuances of partial protection. The challenges that face the implementation of circumcision are many. They're many of the same that will face other interventions, as hopefully they prove efficacious. But circumcision is unique in that it is a one-time treatment. No booster is necessary. Adherence, once the procedure is complete, is complete. We can focus on the hurdles before us, and we should, but we must keep our eye on the prize. Male circumcision in East and Southern Africa, and perhaps in other regions for selected populations, will save millions of lives. Instead of seeing challenges, we can consider opportunities. Opportunities to access vulnerable young men who seldom contact health facilities, to counsel and provide services for their sexual partners, and to provide the training and resources to build capacity of health systems in resource challenge settings. We have a proven efficacious HIV prevention interventions. One cannot help but contemplate that if it were a drug or a compound or a shot with a fancy label, international agencies and donors would have been fighting to be the first to make it available many months, even years ago. But no one stands to profit from male circumcision. No one, that is, but the 4,000 men in Africa who will be infected tomorrow, and their partners and their children. Haven't we delayed long enough? Let's finally take the turn from the long road of contemplation to the highway of action. We must make safe, affordable, voluntary circumcision available now. I'd like to thank these people who have been doing research and who contributed ideas and slides to this presentation. That's much appreciated.
Good morning. My name is Peter Reis from the Academic Medical Center in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and it's actually my pleasure this morning to introduce our second plenary lecturer, Dr. John Rossi. Dr. John Rossi received his doctoral training in genetics under Dr. Claire Burke at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, and postdoctoral training in molecular genetics at Brown University. He is the recipient of an NIH Merit Award for his work on ribozymes and HIV. Work in his laboratory continues to focus upon RNA-based therapeutics, with recent emphasis on function and applications of expressed short hairpin RNAs for therapeutic treatment of HIV and cancers. This research has led to a planned clinical trial for RNAi-based therapy of HIV infection in a gene therapy setting. Dr. Rossi currently is professor and chair of the Division of Molecular Biology and dean of the Graduate School of Biological Sciences at the City of Hope Beckman Research Institute. And I would like you now to join me in welcoming Dr. Rossi to the podium to deliver his lecture entitled Interference and Inhibition, RNAi Mechanisms and Therapeutic Prospects.
Thank you very much. I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk about RNA interference and its potential application, actually its planned application for the treatment of HIV infection. I'm going to begin by giving you a background about RNA interference and hopefully give you some insight into the mechanism before I actually delve into how it can be used for treating HIV infection. So it was really first described in plants, but subsequently the mechanism was shown by investigators using C. elegans as involving double-stranded RNAs, which can actually trigger the silencing of transcripts or genes which are complementary to one of those two strands of RNA. And as a consequence of this this groundbreaking work, Andrew Fire and Craig Mello received the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine last year for their discovery of the mechanism of RNA interference. Importantly, it was subsequently shown to be operative in mammals, and we believe it's part of an innate immune system. involve the protection against double-stranded RNA viruses. But most importantly, there is a class of small RNAs called microRNAs, which are very important regulators of gene expression. And it's believed that these small RNAs, which are only 21 or 22 building blocks in length, control the expression of over one-third of the human genome. And finally, there are some increasing indications that small RNAs can control gene expression at the level of DNA. So I'm just going to go through the mechanistic aspects in the next few slides. The first mechanism of RNA interference, which I'll be describing to you, is one in which a small RNA is acting as a guide to direct a complex of proteins, which then, in turn, cleaves the target RNA, resulting in the functional destruction of that RNA and lack of expression of the protein that RNA encodes. The next mechanism is the one that regulates most of our genes, and each and every one of you in this room has about over a third of your genome being regulated by these small RNAs called microRNAs. And these are similar in size, and I'll talk to you a bit about this more in a moment, but these actually are guides, again, using part of the Watson-Crick complementarity to the messenger RNA as the way of getting a complex of proteins. In this case, it's to the non-coding region of the messenger RNA. And in fact, what they do is they block translation of that messenger RNA, which eventually leads to its degradation, but not in a site-specific fashion. And the third mechanism is chromatin silencing, where small RNAs guide a complex of proteins to promoter regions where they trigger modification of proteins that are associated with DNA, in particular histones, resulting in silencing of gene expression. The major pathway in mammalian cells or in humans is shown here on the upper left, and that is microRNAs are encoded in our genome as often polycistronic or multiple copy components, which are processed by a series of steps from a long transcript into small double-stranded RNAs. And we go through the series of pathways shown here on your left, and then these RNAs then associate with a complex of proteins called the RNA-induced silencing complex, or RISC, which guides the RNA to the untranslated region of the messenger RNA and blocks translation. What we have been able to capitalize on are the components that are involved in RNA interference, but instead of using the translational inhibition mechanism, we use the site-specific cleavage mechanism. And so instead of having partial complementarity to an RNA, we have complete complementarity, where the Watson-Crick-based pairing is uninterrupted. And this allows directed cleavage and degradation of the targeted messenger RNA using the same machinery that the what we call the microRNA pathway would utilize. So just to overview the machinery, there are two steps. One is a processing step, which takes place with these long transcripts in the nucleus of cells, resulting in a hairpin molecule, which then is processed again by a complex of proteins, where then it would affect the downregulation of the messenger RNA in question. And the key component of all of this is a protein, or a family of proteins, called the argonaut proteins. And I show this only to give you an example of how this mechanism works. The green strand is what we would call the guide strand. This is the RNA that is going to be guiding this protein complex to the messenger RNA. The yellow strand is the target strand, and that's the strand that's going to be cleaved. The guide strand is positioned in the enzymatic pocket of this protein in such a way that it directs the cleavage of the target strand in a very sequence-specific manner. That cleavage then triggers further degradation of the messenger RNA. So it's a very precise, beautiful mechanism. One might ask, well, how, since there are two strands, how is the guide strand selected? And the rules seem to be fairly straightforward, and that is the stability of the Watson-Crick-based pairing dictates which strand is going to be selected. So in this case, AU pairing is much less stable because there's only two hydrogen bonds per base, as opposed to GC-based pairing where there's three hydrogen bonds per base, making that a more stable pairing. So the strand that would be selected as the guide strand is this lower strand because it has this thermodynamically lower stability at the end of the molecule. Once that guide strand is selected, then, as I showed you a couple of slides ago, it's aligned with the target RNA, where the proteins then take over and direct the cleavage of the target. And that's a very precise cleavage mechanism, which occurs precisely between bases 10 and 11 relative to the end of this guide strand RNA. And this is important to remember because mismatches in this region near the site of cleavage can actually abrogate the effectiveness of this mechanism. And that's important from the point of view of HIV infection. So I'm now going to switch to applying this to the treatment of HIV infection. And there were several early reports that demonstrated that HIV was a prime target for RNA interference. And we know that we can use RNAi in the context of the gene therapy setting where we can deliver genes that would actually encode the triggers for RNA interference in human cells and thereby result in degradation of HIV transcripts. So how do we trigger this in mammalian cells? The way I'll be describing to you involves using short hairpins that are something like this that can be introduced into human cells. And I'll show you how that's done in a moment. These short hairpins then go through the processing steps, the same processing steps that the microRNAs go through, where one of the two strands, if you design these properly, one of those two strands then becomes the guide strand. That guide strand then will find the target RNA, and it'll direct the cleavage of that target RNA, resulting in functional destruction of the target, in this case, HIV. So how do we get this into the appropriate cells? So we're actually going to use HIV itself as the vehicle for delivering the therapeutic genes that will, again, trigger the inhibition of the virus. And so we use what these are called lentiviral vectors, and these are HIV vectors that have been, or these are HIV sequences which have been basically denuded of all of the important genes for HIV, and just a few genes left behind that will allow us to use this as a vehicle for delivering therapeutic genes to hematopoietic cells. And this is a fairly simple, straightforward mechanism for delivering genes. We insert our therapeutic genes, shown where this gray rectangle is inserted, into this vector. Then the vector is packaged with three HIV proteins, the HIV Rev protein and the GAD-PAL proteins, and then we use an envelope from the VSVG, from Escherichia stomatitis virus, to suit attack this virus so that we can now get a viral particle that will infect a variety of cells, not only CD4-positive cells. And this is important because we would like to be able to use this to infect hematopoietic progenitor cells. Once the virus is produced, then we have a population that can be used to transduce cells, and it goes through a replication cycle identical to what HIV would go through, except this is a defective virus which can no longer produce anything from its long terminal repeat because we have a deletion in that long terminal repeat. So the only genes that are expressed are the genes that we've inserted in the middle of this vector. And this is an example then of a hairpin that's going to be used. This is targeting a common sequence in the TAT and Rev exons of HIV. So we've inserted this hairpin gene in this lentiviral vector backbone. It's under the control of a small promoter called the U6 promoter, which is a class of very abundant promoters found in all human cells, and we can make large amounts of this RNA from the backbone of this vector. So the targets then are a common exon shown here, but shared by the TAT and the Rev genes. And the reason we chose this is that we get double bang for our buck, because if we knock out, if we hit this target, we actually eliminate two proteins from HIV infection. And also, if the virus should mutate to escape HIV, it'll have mutations that will affect two proteins instead of just a single protein. So this is an example now of a lentiviral vector which has the short hairpin RNA that has been transduced into T cells and challenged with HIV. And the yellow curve shows the protection that's afforded by the short hairpin with respect to this actually should be P24 antigen per mil. And the protection is complete out for 2 weeks, shown in this slide, whereas the controls are allowing viral breakthrough. Now, one important aspect of using a compound like this is we don't envision using RNA interference by itself, but we believe that if it's going to be used therapeutically, it'll be used in the context of the current antiretroviral drugs. And so we conducted some experiments just to see if we could find some synergy between a compound such as AZT and the anti-HIV RNA interference trigger. And what this slide shows is that at lower concentrations of AZT, 10 to the minus 8th and 10 to the minus 9th molar, where we start to see some viral breakthrough, if we have this lower concentration in combination with only 25% of the cells protected by this short hairpin, we see a marked inhibition of replication, which shows that there's a synergistic effect of having a small population of cells that are expressing the short hairpin RNA blocking viral replication in the context of a drug. And so we believe that this is an important concept to bring forward into the clinic, because we know that the antiretroviral drugs are going to be continually used. We would like to be able to lower the concentrations or the doses of these drugs in patients taking them. But there is a problem, because HIV is a genetically variable virus. Mutations do emerge, and this is shown on this slide. So the yellow curve represents a breakthrough replication of virus that has been used to infect short hairpin RNA-expressing cells. And when we examine these viruses, uniformly they have mutations in the region that's complementary to the short hairpin RNA trigger. And so this just shows a few of the mutations that we've isolated. We've got a number of these, and you see most of them are double mutations. I want to point out that we've tested the functional role of these mutations in terms of rev function, and in every single case, rev is defective. So these viruses can replicate, but with a very sort of limp-along type of behavior, whereas the rev protein is not very functional. We're about to test the role of these mutations on TAT function as well. So we believe that even though it's a bad news scenario in that the virus can, in fact, escape to a certain extent the pressure of the shRNA, the mutations that do occur make the virus fairly weak. And this just shows an example of that. So if we take a mutation that's occurred in the presence of a short hairpin RNA and use the virus to reinfect fresh cells that express the same short hairpin RNA, the mutation persists. But if we take that virus and now infect naive cells that aren't expressing a short hairpin RNA, rapidly the wild-type sequence reverts back. That's shown on the bottom graph. So that mutation really makes the virus unfit, and the preference is to go back to the wild-type sequence. Now, despite the fact that we can generate defective viruses, we believe that the most effective therapy for treating HIV, of course, and everybody in this room knows that, is to use a combination of drugs. And in the gene therapy setting, really this is something that needs to be tried. And so we want to find out if we can effectively combine several different antiviral genes in a single vector for the treatment of HIV infection. So the rationale then for using anti-HIV gene therapy is shown on this slide. We know that HIV infection is chronic, and it's a lifelong treatment in terms of the antiretroviral drugs. There are an increasing number of patients that have drug-resistant virus. Some of the dosing regimens are difficult, although the single pill is going to alleviate some of those problems. But there are still toxicities that are associated with some of these drugs, and it depends on the patient. And we feel that gene therapy can replace or be used as an adjuvant for chemotherapy, and that's really the goal of the work I'm describing. So there are two approaches that we plan to use. And again, remember, we're using this lentiviral vector construct as our way of delivering the genes. And I'll talk to you about the combinations that are going to be used. So the first, or one of the two methods, is to isolate autologous T cells, that is, take T cells out of patients that are HIV infected. And our goal is to use patients that have are drug failures to genetically modify these T cells, expand them ex vivo, and then reinfuse them into patients. The other approach is to take autologous hematopoietic progenitor cells, and these are easily mobilized into the peripheral blood. These can be collected, genetically modified, and then reinfused back into patients. And I'll describe that trial in a few more slides. But the goal, the virtue of the second approach is that we not only get T cells, but we also get monocytes, macrophages, dendritic cells, and microglial cells modified. These are all targets for HIV infection. So the combination of genes that we are going to use in our clinical trial as shown here. So the bottom shows the shRNA, which I've already described to you. And there are two other small RNAs that are being used as antiviral genes in this particular setting. The one on the left is what we call a decoy. This is a an RNA that actually binds the TAP protein, and it's designed such that it drags the TAP protein into a compartment of the nucleus called the nucleolus, where it sequesters it from HIV infection. The other molecule is an older form of a catalytic RNA called a hammerhead ribozyme. And these ribozymes actually function on their own to base pair with target RNAs and direct site-specific cleavage of that RNA, again resulting in functional degradation of that messenger RNA. So just to briefly show you the efficacy of each of these on their own, the decoy that goes to the nucleolus is shown here. We see this localized in the nucleoli. These are nuclei of human cells, and these are the compartments where ribosomes are made, so we can actually get this molecule to go into the nucleolus. And it drags TAT in there. I don't have that on the slide. And it actually serves as a fairly good anti-HIV reagent on its own. So this is a control, and these are various cells that are expressing this, what we call TAR decoy. The other agent is a ribozyme, which we are using to degrade the chemokine receptor 5, which I'm sure most of you in this room know is a good target because early on in infection, this is the preferred co-receptor for HIV. And we know from the natural genetic experiment in people that the deletion of this 32 base pair deletion in this gene, the homozygous 32 base pair deletion, renders cells highly resistant to HIV infection. And these patients that are even heterozygous for this deletion have good long-term prognosis if they are HIV infected, better response to drugs. And so we feel that this is a good target for downregulation. And we can show that this ribozyme gives about 80 to 90% downregulation of this messenger RNA shown on this bar graph. So the combination then will be effectively used as shown in this cartoon. We try and block the chemokine receptor expression by triggering this cleavage with this ribozyme. But if the virus does get in, because there's still some receptor on the surface, it'll go through its integration pathway and then start to produce RNA. But we'll capture those RNAs with the anti-HIV shRNA, which will trigger the degradation of the TAT-REV genes, and also the decoy, which will sequester the TAT protein away from the virus. So does this work? Okay, so to test this concept, we put all three of these genes into our lentiviral vector backbone, shown here, and these are three independent genetic expression units, so each gene is expressed from its own promoter. And I'll show you now, the testing is to take CD34 positive cord blood or peripheral stem cells. These are the stem cells that will give rise to all of the other hematopoietic cells, and to genetically modify these with a vector, and then to sort these cells out, and then do a number of tests, including an HIV challenge, to look at some of the functional aspects of these genetically modified cells. So the first thing we asked was, can all three of these transgenes be expressed in these CD34 cells? And this is what's called a northern gel analysis. We're actually using a radioactive probe to identify the individual RNAs that are made in these cells. And we can see that this is the ribozyme, here's the decoy, and here's the short hairpin RNA, all expressed very abundantly in these CD34 cells. We also wanted to ask if expressing these foreign RNAs in these progenitor cells had any impact on their ability to differentiate into various myeloid lineages. And these are all of the different myeloid lineages that were looked at. And we can see that the green bar, which is our triple expressing construct, we're looking at the percentage of each of these markers, is really unaffected by expressing this triple construct. So this looks to be safe in terms of its effect, lack of any type of negative impact on myeloid differentiation. And in terms of its ability to protect against HIV infection, it's really quite profound. So in every case we've ever looked at, this triple construct gives complete protection. We see no viral breakthrough whatsoever, whereas single hairpins, eventually by a couple of weeks, we start to see the virus will break through, either by a point mutation or by just overwhelming the single hairpin. So we know that this triple combination is really going to be protective, and we've yet to see any resistant virus break through in long-term experiments using this approach. And finally, we used a SCID-HU mouse model in collaboration with Ramesh Akin at Colorado State University, who tested a number of mice using CD34 cells that were genetically modified with our vector, and then infused them into a SCID-HU mouse that had a fetal thymic implant, and then let these go through differentiation into T lymphocytes, collected those T lymphocytes, and challenged them with T-tropic HIV, and showed that, in fact, again, a strong protection against HIV infection, even though this time we're not using the chemokine receptor, we're using the CXCR4 receptor. So the other two antivirals are providing strong protection on their own. So to summarize then, we see long-term protection against HIV replication in primary CD34-derived monocytes and macrophages, lack of immunogenicity and normal myeloid differentiation, and normal thymic T-cell development and resistance to T-tropic HIV. So the trials that I'm talking to you about are one of the trials is already underway, and this trial involves using autologous CD34 cells from AIDS lymphoma patients. And without going into a great amount of detail, this turns out to be a preferred treatment for AIDS-related lymphoma. Patients that have undergone frontline chemotherapy for their AIDS-related lymphoma have still a fairly high probability of relapse within the first year, and that relapse can be fatal. We found that by using an autologous stem cell transplant in a full hematopoietic stem cell transplant setting, that the cure rate, or at least the long-term rate of non-relapse, has been significantly increased to 85%. And we have now, at the City of Hope, where I'm from, done over 30 patients, and the average survival is 85% over this long period of time. So we feel that this is a good class of patients to begin with for a gene therapy trial, because we'll benefit their lymphoma, and at the same time, we can genetically modify their hematopoietic cells to be resistant to HIV infection. And so this is the protocol that's going to be used. We have an HIV-infected AIDS lymphoma patient who has undergone successful chemotherapy for his lymphoma or her lymphoma, but has a high probability of relapse. They will have their CD34 cells mobilized into the peripheral blood circulation, which then will be collected. These CD34 cells then will be genetically modified with our vector with the triple construct, and then they will be infused along with unmodified cells into the patients under a full bone marrow transplant setting, and we'll be following these patients for the next several years. The other trial, which will begin shortly, is to, again, take T-cells out of these patients, genetically modify these T-cells, expand them ex vivo, and then reinfuse them. And this is a different class of patients. These will be patients who have otherwise are drug failures. So just to summarize then the steps to the clinic, we had to create a final version of our vector. We had to get rid of our marker gene. We had to scale up the production of that clinical vector, had to optimize the transduction protocols. We had to analyze all the sites where that vector integrates. We analyzed over 130 different sites, and in every case, we found that it integrated into an intervening sequence or an intron. We performed microarray analyses to look at perhaps the effects of expressing these small RNAs on cellular transcripts, and we found no consistent effect. And so we presented our findings to the U.S. NIH Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, which has to approve all these gene therapy trials, and they submitted a bunch of recommendations to the FDA. We filed our FDA application in January of this past year, of this year, and we received our final approval from the FDA to go ahead with the stem cell trial for AIDS lymphoma patients, and we've actually enrolled our first patient, and he is being infused within the next week, and we'll be monitoring his progress over the next few months. We plan to enroll 4 more patients in this trial over the next year. So all of the vector production was carried out at the City of Hope, where I'm employed, and we have our own production facility for GMP manufacture of biologicals. We made enough virus to treat 6 patients in the BMT procedure and 6 autologous T-cell patients. So just to summarize then, the trial highlights is this is the first human clinical trial using a lentiviral vector for hematopoietic stem cells. It's the first human clinical trial with expressed RNA interference triggers, the short hairpin RNA, and it's the first triple combination therapy for the treatment of HIV/AIDS using gene therapy. And I'd like to just acknowledge then the people, many people that have been involved in this work, members of my own lab, as well as my collaborators at the City of Hope, shown on this slide, and I thank you for your attention.
Good morning. I'm Ian Weller from University College London and Treasurer of the International AIDS Society. Before I introduce the next speaker, a short announcement, and that is after this plenary, the last talk, I would ask you to remain in your seats as Kanikar, who's working with Thai people living with HIV and AIDS, wants to speak to you. Well, most of you who have been working in the clinical field will know of Joe Aron's contribution to HIV clinical trials and clinical research. He's Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina, and he graduated from Harvard Medical School and did his residency at the Massachusetts General Hospital. As many of you will know, he's been involved in clinical and translational research now for many years. He's principal investigator of the UNC's AIDS Clinical Research Group and head of its clinical core, that is, of the Center for AIDS Research. He's been a really key figure in international studies with the AIDS Clinical Trials Group in the United States and its HIV Prevention and Treatment Network. And like a number of clinical scientists in the North, he is also spending time now working in the South in Malawi. I can't think of anyone more appropriate to give this plenary new kids on the block, novel agents, and treatment strategies. Joe.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian. That was very nice and fortunately very, very brief. I'd like to thank the organizers for this opportunity to give the talk, though not particularly for the title. I'm also grateful for the opportunity to have studied some of these new drugs and have worked with colleagues and study design and interpreting the results. And I actually am fortunate to see some of the benefit of these drugs in the clinic. Now, we've heard some terrific talks, and yesterday we had wonderful plenary talks. And I'd like to be as professorial as Michael Lederman, and I'd like to be urbane and witty like Dr. Gazzard, but I think I'm going to need to be like a sports announcer on methamphetamine to get through this. So I'm going. Hold on. First, I just want to point out to people that this is now 20 years of antiretroviral therapy, and it's almost 20 years to the day that Margaret Fischel and her colleagues published that first paper on AZT monotherapy. And those of you who are old enough, like Dr. Cooper, right, remember, that's my only Dr. Cooper joke, I promise, that 19 patients died in the placebo arm, and only one patient died on the AZT arm in 6 months of study 20 years ago. So why do we need new agents? Well, I think for treatment-naive patients, it's clear we need well-tolerated, highly active, convenient antiretroviral therapy for all individuals who need treatment. The examples such as women of childbearing potential, individuals with TB and other complex medical illnesses, as Dr. Gazzard pointed out yesterday. And of course, we have transmitted drug resistance, and we're learning more about perhaps the effect of transmitted minority variants. In treatment-experienced individuals, we also need to expand our treatment choices. Some of our treatments are complex and toxic. And in particular, as we've heard already several times in this conference, even in patients with the most resistant virus, our goal now is full suppression of HIV replication. In the developed world, multi-drug resistant variants exist in about 5 to 10% of patients. And I think even in patients with less resistant virus, we should be able to have more success with these new agents. In the developing world, with clinical monitoring, we're seeing the emergence of highly nucleoside-resistant variants, and these patients have limited treatment options. This is just one study from Thailand that pointing out that patients who have failed a trimmune-like therapy not only have 3TC resistance and NNRTI resistance, but they're likely to have thymidine analog mutations, they may have K65R, and even some of these multi-drug resistance complexes. So these patients need additional therapy. So I'm just going to jump into it. There are lots of new drugs in clinical development. I'm not going to talk about the ones that are in early clinical development, but there are several presentations here at this meeting. There are two CCR5 inhibitors, one by Incyte Pharmaceuticals, which is a one pill once a day that has been studied of short term. Also, Progenix has a monoclonal antibody directed against CCR5. Fosalvudine is being presented by Pedro Kahn, our president, in a session, a late breaker poster session tomorrow. Aprocitabine is a nucleoside analog that is being studied in nucleoside experienced patients with 3TC resistance. And finally, there's a new non-nucleoside being developed by Pfizer that will be presented in a late breaker session tomorrow. But I'm really going to concentrate on these six drugs, which are in late-stage clinical development, for which we have pretty extensive clinical data. And I'll try to point out the highlights of each of these drugs. I'm going to start with integrase inhibitors. My friend Trip Gulick said I have to do this in some logical way. I should start by the life cycle. But instead, I'm going to just do it the way I want to. Which is to start with the integrase inhibitors. There's two in clinical development, raltegravir and elvitegravir. I think it's important in understanding the integrase mechanism. There are at least three steps in the mechanism of integration, association of the integrase with DNA, 3' processing of the ends of the viral DNA, but then finally strand transfer. And it was really Daria Hazuda and her colleagues at Merck that showed us by inhibiting strand transfer, we could really develop effective integrase inhibitors that work not only in vitro, but in vivo. So raltegravir is the integrase inhibitor. that's gone farthest in clinical development, and there have been two studies, the benchmark studies in treatment-experienced patients with resistant virus. These were two randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, parallel trials in these triple-class resistant patients. The primary endpoint for this trial was actually at 16 weeks. Patients were randomized to receive raltegravir at 400 milligrams twice a day, plus optimized background chosen by resistance testing, or placebo plus optimized background chosen by resistance testing. And studies were done in Europe and Asia and then North and South America. Somehow Peru got displaced and went off with Asia and Europe. And the point here is I went through the study design pretty carefully because you're going to see this study design several times for the different agents. The bottom line data are, these are actually less than 50 copy data, so these were not, this was not the primary endpoint, but with this less than 50 copy data, you can see in the yellow line that patients treated with raltegravir, if I can make this mouse work, had 61 and 62% of the patients were less than 50 copies, compared to about 30 to 35% of patients in the placebo group. I'm going to show you now subset data to help us understand the activity of these drugs, and I'm going to try to show you similar data from each of the studies. First of all, this is less than 400 copy data, not less than 50 copy data. Keep that in mind. Also, patients on the benchmark study were allowed to receive darunavir and ritonavir if available, and T20 if available. So looking at the patients whose background therapy had a GSS of zero, so the background therapy had minimal activity, probably not zero activity, but minimal activity, because you can see that 10% of the control arm was below detectable. Fully 57% of the patients treated with raltegravir were below 400 copies at 16 weeks. But I think the important point here is that when there were two or more agents, almost 90% of patients were less than 400 copies at 16 weeks in this trial. And in fact, if you looked at patients that received raltegravir, darunavir, ritonavir, and T20, 98% or 43 out of 44 of those patients had less than 400 copies at 16 weeks. Raltegravir has also been compared to efavirenz in treatment-naive patients in a phase 2 study, both combined with tenofovir and 3TC. And what you can see is that at the end of 24 weeks, they're very similar proportions, less than 50 copies, approaching or exceeding 80%. What was notable, though, is the rate of decline in the viral load in these patients. So you can see in the raltegravir-treated group, fully 60% of patients were less than 50 copies by 4 weeks, compared to approximately 20% with efavirenz. And later this morning, Marty Markowitz will present the actual 48-week data from this study. And then I think it's John Murray from David Cooper's group is going to also discuss the viral dynamics also in this session tomorrow, just later this morning. The second integrase inhibitor that I'd like to talk about is elvitegravir. This is being developed by Gilead. The phase 2 study that has been presented was a randomized active control. So this is not an necessarily optimized background. It's a comparison between three doses of elvitegravir and a boosted a protease inhibitor. About half of the patients got darunavir, ritonavir, and a quarter of the patients got tipranavir, ritonavir. So this is a head-to-head comparison. They were combined with either with nucleosides plus or minus T20. You can see that the three doses of elvitegravir had varying activity. The lowest dose, 20 milligrams with 100 milligrams of ritonavir, actually was stopped at 16 weeks for lack of efficacy. If we look more carefully at the highest dose, 125 milligrams with 100 milligrams of ritonavir, we can see this dichotomy where patients who received L-Vitegravir with at least one active nucleoside or T20 had rapid and then sustained suppression. However, if the patients received L-Vitegravir without an active nucleoside or T20, you see a profound two-log response and then a rapid rebound back towards baseline. So what about integrase inhibitor resistance? These are looking at treatment failures, virologic failures from three different studies, the Merck phase 2 study, the benchmark study, and then that L-Vitegravir phase 2 study that I just showed you. And basically, these are the patients who had virologic failure and were able to be genotyped. And what you can see is that between 80 and just over 90% of patients that have failure and can be genotyped have integrase inhibitor mutations. For raltegravir, there are two major pathways, an N155 pathway and a Q148 pathway, and the 148-140 mutation is the most common. Most patients who fail have multiple mutations, so it's not a single mutation. And in the phase 2 study, at least, the majority of the treatment failures had a GSS of 0. With L-Vitegravir, there are actually multiple different mutations and combinations of mutations, some including 155 and 148, and the median number of mutations per variant was actually 4. And there's a poster here looking at two patients that failed L-Vitegravir who appear not to respond to raltegravir. These are data from Daria Hazuda and her group at Merck looking at this issue of cross-resistance. And basically what you can see is that with raltegravir and L-Vitegravir, with certain mutational combinations, you can see a substantial degree of cross-resistance. The good news is that Merck and hopefully other companies are developing compounds that look like they have pretty profound activity against these resistant viruses. So to summarize about integrase inhibitors, raltegravir, extremely potent, rapid suppression, and I didn't show you any of the tolerability data from the phase 3 study because basically there were no clinically important differences from placebo in terms of toxicity. There is a high risk of resistance with treatment failure. It is dosed twice daily, but because it's glucuronidated in its metabolism, there are only modest drug interactions. When the Merck pooled their data and analysis, they did find a greater number of malignancies with raltegravir. However, with the extensive review, there's no direct evidence that there's a relationship between raltegravir and these malignancies, and the difference was not statistically significant. If you look at L-Vitegravir, it's in phase 2 study. They've chosen a dose. The phase 3 studies are being planned. It has clear cross-resistance consequences, I think, probably in both directions. It is once daily, but it needs to be administered with ritonavir. And then probably the most important point is that the a high likelihood of success with raltegravir and also probably with L-Vitegravir is really dependent on other active agents in the background therapy. So now I'll talk about CCR5 inhibitors. I think people here are familiar with the fact that HIV entry is a three-step process. GP120 binds with CD4. There's a conformational change, and then there's a binding of the second receptors, either CCR5 or CXCR4, and finally there's a fusion that's mediated by GP41. There are basically two groups of viruses. There are five viruses. These are viruses that use the CCR5 co-receptor. In vitro, they are non-syncytium-inducing. They're the viruses that are most frequently transmitted, and they're prevalent in early disease. Then there are the dual-tropic and X4 variants, and I've lumped these together very specifically. They both use the X4, the CXCR4 receptor. Of course, dual-tropic can use both. Viruses have the syncytium-inducing phenotype. They emerge later in disease, up to 50% of patients, at least in subtype B. And they are, at least in natural history studies, associated with accelerated disease progression and CD4 cell decline. The prevalence of co-receptors, as measured by a phenotypic or assay, a tropism or assay trophile being developed by Monogram, early in disease, treatment-naive patients, about 80 to 90% are R5 tropic. Later in disease, however, these are clade B treatment experienced patients, the proportion that have dual mixed or X4 virus can approach a 50%. So now I'm going to talk about Maraviroc, which is in phase 3 development. There are two studies, Motivate 1 and 2. Same basic design, triple class resistant, two parallel studies, optimized background plus either placebo or Maraviroc once a day or Maraviroc twice a day. These patients all had to be R5 by the tropism assay. And in this particular study, because when it was started in PK interactions, there's no darunavir in the optimized background therapy in the study, and it's a 24-week initial analysis. So here are the results of Motivate 1 and Motivate 2. You can see that between 40 and 48% of patients are less than 50 copies. This is at 24 weeks in your typical non-completer equals failure analysis. And with placebo, the rates are low, 24 and 20%, so there's about a doubling of the antiviral effect with Maraviroc in these studies. If we break down again by the susceptibility in the background therapy, again, this is less than 50 copies for raltegravir. I showed you less than 400 copies, so there's differences here. You can see that with zero active agents in the background, at least as defined by a combination of genotype-phenotype resistance testing, a relatively small proportion of Maraviroc-treated patients achieve a less than 50 copy result, though it is substantially greater than placebo. But if there are at least two active agents in the background, you can see that more than 50% of patients get less than 50 copies. You'll also note that here, when there are three or more active agents, it's a little bit harder to tease out the additional effect of Maraviroc. Maraviroc is also being studied in treatment-naive patients compared head-to-head with efavirenz, both given with combivir, and these data are going to be presented by Mike Sag later in the meeting. Again, this is R5 virus only as determined by the tropism assay. The study actually originally had three arms, and the Q-day arm was stopped. And this is the late-breaker presentation by Mike Sag. The Quiveroc is the second CCR5 inhibitor. We have 24-week data here from an ACDG study. Again, these were treatment-experienced patients. They had to be R5 tropic by the tropism assay. You can see a strong activity at 24 weeks in the 10 milligram and 15 milligram once-a-day doses. In this study, 8 patients developed malignancy, 6 on the Quiveroc treated group, 2 in placebo, though 1 in the placebo was after crossover to Quiveroc. The team has analyzed this very carefully and really could not establish a direct association with Quiveroc. And then, again, this morning, Tripkulik will present the 48-week results of this study. So for CCR5 inhibitors and virologic failure, there are two mechanisms. One is actually the emergence of pre-existing X4 variants. So it's not evolution of R5 to X4, it's emergence of X4 variants that exist in the population. And I'm sure Doug Richman will discuss this as he gives results from the resistance meeting. Obviously, if X4 viruses emerge, these viruses would be cross-resistant to other CCR5 inhibitors. To date, the emergence of these X4 viruses have not been associated with substantial immunologic consequences, as we're seeing in the natural history studies. But we really have relatively short-term follow-up. HIV, being incredibly clever, can also become resistant to R5 inhibitors by actually using the receptor with the compound bound. This is difficult to detect without phenotype assay, but in this particular type of resistance, there may not be cross-resistance. So for the CCR5 inhibitors, Maraviroc, again, I didn't show you tolerability data from the phase 3 trial because basically there were no clinically important differences from placebo and Maraviroc. So it was very well tolerated. It's P450 metabolized, but it's neither an inducer nor an inhibitor. There's twice daily dosing is likely how it will be dosed, though it's probably going to have multiple different doses depending on which drugs it's co-administered with. Key point, there doesn't appear to be any virologic activity against viruses that are dual mixed viruses. And this has been looked at now in several different studies, both of Maraviroc and Quiveroc. 40 to 50% of treatment experienced patients have dual mixed viruses. And unfortunately, there may be dual mixed viruses present that aren't detected by the current tropism assay. So even if the assay reads out as R5 only, there is the potential for dual mixed variants to be there. In the studies that have been done, approximately 5 to 10% of patients have gone from baseline screening to baseline, have actually switched tropism from R5 to X4. Vicriviroc is once daily, but as yet the optimal dose has not been decided. The association with malignancy certainly needs a continued evaluation. There was a treatment-naive study of Vicriviroc that was actually stopped because of decreased efficacy compared to efavirenz, probably related to drug exposure. So what about new agents from existing classes? There are two. They're NNRTI inhibitors. One is etravirine. The other is rilpivirine. The etravirine data will be presented at this meeting on these two DUETS trials, but these are already published, so I feel comfortable showing you these data. These, again, are two parallel design studies, treatment-experienced patients randomized to get etravirine plus optimized background. In this study, everybody got darunavir as part of optimized background. Patients had to have at least one NNRTI mutation at screening or documented NNRTI resistance by genotype, and they had to have three or more primary PI resistance mutations. So this is a highly resistant treatment population. These are the 24-week less than 50 results that have been published. The less than 50 was actually the primary endpoint for this study, which is the first time in a treatment experienced population. And you can see approximately a 17 to 18% increase in the proportion of patients who got less than 50 with etravirine compared to placebo. Though in a subgroup of patients who were naive to T20, it was difficult to tease out additional activity of etravirine in this setting. Remember, all patients got darunavir. So if we go to the subset analysis that I've chosen to show you with the other drugs, this is actually based on phenotypic susceptibility, or PSS. We can see that in patients where there were no active drugs in the background based on PSS score, then 47% of patients got less than 50 at 24 weeks in Duet 1, it was 44% in Duet 2. Remember, all these patients did get darunavir, and darunavir susceptibility was defined as less than 10. So some of these patients had viruses intermediately susceptible to darunavir. However, again, same message. If there were two or more agents in the background, if there are two agents in the background, the proportion less than 50 was substantially improved. Though again, like maraviroc, when there were three or more agents, it was a little harder to see the added activity of etravirine. We now are learning about etravirine resistance mutations. They're listed here on this slide. And basically, if you have an increasing number of these mutations at baseline, the likelihood of response decreases. The good news is that 86% of these patients had two or fewer of these etravirine resistance mutations. Some of them are familiar to you, like 181C. 181C alone did not have an impact on response, but only in combination with other etravirine resistance mutations. Finally, rilpivirine is another second-generation NNRTI. It has activity against resistant viruses, but it's being studied in treatment-naive patients. This is a head-to-head phase 2 study compared to efavirenz with three doses of TMC-278, and you can see similar activity at a 48-week period. So our next-generation NNRTI, etravirine, twice daily dosing, but it actually has a half-life of 30 to 40 hours. It's twice daily because of initial pill burden. The current pill burden is two tablets twice a day. Rash, typically mild, was the most common AE seen in the DUET studies. There were no differences in CNS effects between etravirine and placebo in the DUET studies. Unfortunately, those etravirine RAMs might not be reported on all genotype reports, and there is appear to be limited added effect if there are three or more active agents. Rilpivirine, once daily dosing, small milligram, optimal for fixed dose combination, possibly lipid neutral, and perhaps less CNS side effects than efavirenz, though it was an unblinded study. So I have three summary slides that will be relatively quick. For treatment-naive patients,
I think rilpivirine, raltegravir, and maybe maraviroc plus two nucleosides may improve tolerability and expand our treatment population, but it'll also allow us novel combinations that might spare some of the drugs like nucleosides or ritonavir from our treatment-naive patients. In treatment-experienced patients, resistance testing guides therapy were available. We want to avoid adding one active new drug, no matter how tempting that might be, in combination with other agents that aren't active. The greatest activity will be with agents with no likelihood of pre-existing resistance. Integrase, T20 and T20 naive patients. Remember that for etravirine, protease inhibitors, and for the CCR5 inhibitors, there's this risk of pre-existing resistance. I think of the X4 variants that are below detectable, a little bit like pre-existing resistance. And if we have two or more active drugs, then perhaps we don't really know yet. Do we need to use three? Do we need to use four? And hopefully those studies will be coming. Finally, in treatment-experienced patients in the developing world, perhaps new agents will allow alternatives to recycled nucleosides and maybe even third-line therapy in the developing world. Finally, for all patients, I think we need zero tolerance for virologic failure. Our regimens should be designed for complete success, and we need a high bar for safety, even in our most treatment-experienced patients. Thank you. I'd like to acknowledge these people that helped me through my anxiety, shared slides, and were generally just particularly helpful. Thank you.